This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's episode, we will be discussing whether political correctness has a valuable role in society. We'll also be looking at whether today's budget shows how the EU referendum has changed the government's approach to politics. And finally, we will be discussing whether young people just don't know how to rave anymore. So in this week's issue of the magazine, Simon Barnes says that he understands why political correctness is seen as being so silly. But without it, life would be very difficult for his son Eddie, who has Down syndrome. 50 years ago, people with Down syndrome were shunned by society. But thanks to political correctness, Eddie is now treated with kindness, generosity and respect by most people. I'm now joined by Simon and Tom Slater from Spiked to discuss whether political correctness is actually a good thing. So, Simon, could you describe how you changed your mind on political correctness?
Not exactly changing my mind on political correctness, but becoming directly involved in the whole question came when going public with the fact that my youngest son, Eddie, who's now 14, has Down syndrome. And so when you're walking out into the public ways and dealing with the general just problems of bringing up any child, you come across against the world. And the world, as I find it today, is prepared to tolerate and do good things for and to accommodate Eddie as best it possibly can. Back in my day when I was at school, we used to have terrible jokes about such people as Eddie, and we called them names. They were not particularly nasty playground names, the names everybody used for Down syndrome people, which I am, I think, physically rather than psychologically unable to utter. These were people despised. They were kept mostly out of sight. And if you came across someone with Down syndrome, you felt you had a right to feel upset, disturbed, and angry with the person who was bringing such a person out in public. In today's atmosphere of political correctness, I can go to a restaurant, I can walk down the street, I can do anything else with Eddie, including taking him to the doctors, what's happening, dealing with his schooling and all that kind of stuff. And it's dealt with as a human being, not as an opprobrious name. And I think that is a serious advance for any society.
And so, Tom Slater, do you think that you would respond in the same way as Simon? He writes in his piece in this week's magazine that there was a time when he advocated the total freedom of usage of any word in existence in pursuit of truth and meaning. Do you think you might also change your mind in the circumstances he's described?
Not at all, because I think we need to separate out a couple of things here, really, because I think we are a little bit in danger of confusing political correctness, first of all, just for good manners, but more profoundly, by a kind of attributing to it certain social gains that really, I think, had nothing to do with it. The fact that over the past, say, 20 or 30 years, we've become a lot more accepting of disabled people, people of different races and the sexes as well, sexual orientation, I think broadly that's had to do with society moving on through a lot of campaigning, a lot of hard work, a lot of hard arguments as well. And I think to attribute this to the kind of project of political correctness as it developed over the 90s is not only effective, untrue. I think it's a little unfair as well. Those who advocate political correctness these days, not lumping Simon in here at all, is the idea that if it wasn't for this kind of enforced new sort of moral code that we have, that everyone would almost lapse back into a bit of a state of bigotry. I think it's almost selling society short a little bit to attribute all of these social gains to political correctness. And we're also risking missing the very censorious impact it has and the extent to which it can just silence political viewpoints.
Simon, is it not the case that you're just defending kindness, aren't you, rather than political correctness per se?
It's a part of a symptom of a developing society. I'm not attempting to defend any kind of zealotry or dictatorial approaches, but I can tell you the fact that it is politically incorrect to use an opprobrious term about a child with Down syndrome seems to me to reflect a great and widespread gain throughout society. And it's this being pernickety about words has been a part of that process, and I'm very glad about it.
And Tom Slater, language is powerful, isn't it? The saying sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me isn't really true, is it? So why should people use terms that hurt people, particularly those who are vulnerable?
No, definitely. I mean, I think words do hurt, which is why I think freedom of speech and not trying to kind of enforce language rules like this is so important, because it's really through that we can properly answer back. I think the problem with political correctness a lot of the time is that it really focuses on the words people use, the language that they use, often without really tackling the base problem, which is if you tell someone to stop using a certain word, telling someone to shut up ultimately doesn't change their mind. I mean, I think ultimately the thing about political correctness is we need to separate out these parts here. Society has moved on. I think political correctness gains a lot of legitimacy from saying that it had something to do with it, but ultimately I think they're very, very separate. Because bearing in mind the idea that if we are to move on, if we are to challenge hateful, upsetting ideas and the words that express them, we need to have as free and open a forum as possible. And I think on a range of issues, whether it's immigration, whether it's the new discussion around gender, the way in which the policing of particular words actually stifles that discussion, whether or not it's the pronouns you can use in an article to discuss a certain person, or whether or not it's the case that airing an anti-immigration view is going to see you labelled a racist. I think that ultimately, if we do want to tackle the kind of mean-spirited, hateful views that underpin those words, we need a free and open forum. My problem is that I think political correctness, far from being a part of this fantastic egalitarian shift, has ultimately nothing to do with it, and it actually holds back that kind of discussion.
Simon Barnes, do you agree with that it's holding back the discussion, or do you think, as you argue in your piece, that it has been largely helpful?
I think this is just intellectualising about a subject and not dealing with the practicalities of just not working, being down at the coalface of inequality, not understanding what it's like to be in the position of the weak being bullied by the strong. I think that's an interesting and clever argument, but it doesn't actually stand up when you're at the sharp end of it.
And this is a really interesting question, isn't it, Tom Slater, that it's very easy for those who are perhaps in a group that hasn't been persecuted to make an argument about the merits of freedom of speech, when really they haven't been subjected to some of the terms that people want to either ban or to make unacceptable in society.
No, 100%. And I think we do need a level of kind of self-awareness here. But at the same time, I think that really this isn't just my kind of, I'm glad to see that Simon thinks it's clever, but this isn't just my kind of intellectual argument. I think it's really borne out through history. Suppressing ideas doesn't make them go away. And I think that's the lesson that we really see. But I think if we're talking especially about political correctness, another thing that we really have to isolate here is that I think part of the problem with it is that it actually ignores the kind of material reality that a lot of people experience. And one example I would use is the huge furore we saw a few years ago around the Katie Hopkins Sun column, in which she called migrants cockroaches. Now, a lot of people took issue with this, and this was kind of at the beginning of the refugee crisis. It wasn't as sharply felt. But what seemed to happen is there was more column inches devoted, more outrage targeted at the words that she had used, rather, you know, in that 300 word section of a column, rather than the thousands of people who had been dying in the Mediterranean. So I do completely take Simon's point, but I think political correctness is something very different. I think it's an obsession with words that can not only be deeply censorious, but can actually focus so much on the words people use that you actually miss the material reality and the problems that are there. So ultimately, I think we're talking about two different things.
So finally, Simon, is it right that many campaigners for political correctness undermine their own cause? You list some slightly ludicrous examples at the start of your piece about yoga lessons being cancelled because of fears of cultural appropriation. Surely that's not particularly helpful to the cause of kindness that you set out.
Do you know what students are trying to do, and I was doing when I was a student? You remember when you were a student? What students are trying to do is to make a better job of running the world than their parents did. And it's ludicrous because they're young, they don't know what they're doing, but they're trying to do good things. I think rather than getting excited about all that kind of stuff, you should deal with that with a kind of weary tolerance and wish them luck and hope that they can go ahead and save the world, because it's their world. They're the ones who are taking over.
That was Simon Barnes and Tom Slater. A quick reminder of our special subscription offer just for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. Now on to the budget. In his column this week, James Forsyth says that George Osborne's budget has brought the focus back to Britain. I'm now joined by James and Fraser Nelson, our editor, to discuss what they made of it. So, James, will we remember this budget next week?
I don't think this budget will live long in the memory. It's not one of the most memorable ones that Osborne has done. He was quite... I thought he did an astute political job, considering how little room for manoeuvre he had. You know, he's hemmed in by both the worsening fiscal forecast and the kind of political limitations that are imposed on him by the EU referendum. So I thought he did enough to get himself some decent headlines. But people won't remember this as one of his great reforming budgets.
Fraser, what did you think of the way George Osborne used the warnings from the Office for Budget Responsibility about Brexit in his speech?
Well, when I heard him make that point, I thought, this is outrageous. He's taking the independent Office for Budget Responsibility and trying to enlist it as an actor in the debate. And then I thought, how come the OBR even said those things? It's supposed to be neutral. And when I actually saw the document afterwards, the OBR said no such thing. It was studiously impartial. It was saying, yes, some people think there we could be a lot worse off. Other people think we could be a lot better off. We just don't know. Now, George Osborne translated this into uncertainty with negative connotation and basically spun the OBR. So when you look at it, there are so many variables to Britain leaving the EU that nobody can say with any degree of certainty if it's going to be better or if it's going to be worse. I mean, neither side can conclusively make that claim, and the OBR simply made this point. So the Chancellor was being characteristically naughty in misrepresenting the OBR.
Do you think that's going to cause him political trouble, James?
Well, I think anything he said about Brexit was going to cause political trouble. I think if he wasn't accurately representing the OBR, that was particularly foolish, because that gives him a stick which to beat him. I mean, the more controversial thing will be this Treasury risks of the risk of leaving the EU document they intend to put out. As I understand it, that will be pretty much the last thing the government releases before the PERDA rules kick in a month beforehand. And that is designed to kind of frame the debate. That is going to be the kind of massive, if we leave the economy, we'll get this massive shock and it will be hit. And there'll be a row about the use of a civil service in producing that document.
I'd say that the one problem most ones got here is that all of these disaster scenarios involve the pound taking a plunge, 10%, maybe 20%. But if that happens, then our exports become 10 or 20% cheaper for the rest of the world. So no matter what the extra tariff is, if we're going to get one, that will be about 3%, 4%, easily offset by plunging sterling. So if the Treasury is planning another dodgy dossier, I think it could come back to rebound on George Osborne if he's putting too much emphasis on currency risk.
And his decision to quote the OBR's comments on Brexit were part of his wider framing of the budget speech as being responding to the economic storm clouds that are gathering. But James, were you surprised by how little there was on how he'd respond to these economic storm clouds? But I didn't really hear very much about these terrible cuts that he was claiming he was going to have to make.
Listening to George Osborne today, I got the impression that he thinks that the OBR will change its forecasts again. So he's not.
So he can't be bothered. Basically.
So basically, he'll make the sums add up for his £10 billion surplus, but he's not going to detail where these cuts are going to fall, because they might be smaller or larger than the OBR are currently saying, because of the volatility in the OBR's forecast at the moment.
There's a wonderful line in the OBR report which counts the amount of cuts Osborne has said he'll do but hasn't said how. It calls them the as yet unidentified cuts, and we're now a total £3.5 billion. So he's not taking it seriously, but then again, he's right not to. You just simply cannot forecast anything more than 2 years in advance, and yet we're supposed to believe that the OBR is telling us
what
we're
going to do.
It's all a nonsense, so I can agree with the Chancellor. It's not worth taking too seriously.
And Fraser, your graphs of doom that you produce at every budget and autumn statement are famous in Westminster. Are they more miserable than usual or more upbeat?
They're a tiny bit more miserable than usual, but it doesn't really matter. More miserable for government finances, but things like employment are good and are getting better. Inflation's very low. I mean, right now, the debt situation is bad, but most chancellors would kill for the hand that George Osborne's got. And employment has never been higher in this country. The cost of living is not going up, and we're about to see real disposable income start a sustained recovery that's going to last for years. So by and large, Brits feel, have reason to feel pretty confident, which of course George Osborne likes in a way, but he doesn't like it ahead of the referendum, because if we feel confident, we might think, well, we can take the risk and vote for Brexit. So he wants to keep us just scared enough to vote in, but not so scared that we think he's done a bad job.
And what do you think the worst bit of news was?
The worst bit of news, it was probably his deficit target slipping again. Mind you, it slipped every time he gets to his feet in the budget, so I'm not sure there is that much hanging on it. I mean, this is the fourth budget we've had in 12 months from George Osborne, so there is not much we didn't already know in it.
And he always seems to get away with missing his targets, doesn't he, James? Or do you think at some point this is going to cause Osborne trouble?
I think you'll always get away with missing his targets as long as Labour is not fiscally credible. I mean, in politics...
So he's got a few decades.
In politics, then. It's a choice, not a referendum. Do people really think that John McDonnell would be a better steward of the public finances than George Osborne? As long as that's the case, I think he can get away with that kind of stuff.
And what are we expecting over the next few weeks? Are we expecting any rows at all from Conservative MPs about what was announced today, or are they going to be very happy?
I think there will be... Some people will dislike the sugar levy on ideological grounds. I didn't see, listening to the budget, many things that are going to cause parliamentary rebellions.
Fraser?
No, I think George Osborne played it safe. Of all the things he wanted from this budget, he wanted something that was not going to cause him problems ahead of the referendum with his party.
And also, he personally can't afford many more U-turns. I mean, there have been a few too many of them in recent months.
I mean, I suspect he spent the last 2 or 3 weeks going through this budget, weeding out anything that looked remotely controversial. And I think he by and large succeeded.
And so this means that we're going to return to the EU referendum debate very quickly. Yeah. Indeed. What are we expecting over the next few weeks?
Well, both parts of the campaign suspect this will be a slightly more calmer pace than it has been in the first few weeks. But I think one of the things that is going to become a bigger and bigger part of this EU referendum campaign is the Turkish question, which is notionally the UK government supports Turkey joining the EU. That is going to be used by the OUT campaign to bolster their argument, which is, hang on a second, 75 million more people are going to become entitled to free movement rights if Turkey joins. Does taking the EU's border all the way up to Syria really make Britain safer? I think they will try and use it to bring up both the immigration argument and the security argument.
But James, I was fascinated to read in your column this week. You end on the idea that George Osborne will actually say, look, I'm going to give Britain a referendum on whether Turkey should join the EU. Another referendum in the same way that France. But you reckon that might be a rabbit he pulls out of his hat just before the referendum if it's going badly for him?
Yes, I think the big question is this, is what do they do if Leave are ahead in the final week? In the Scottish referendum, the Unionist parties got together and they could promise more powers. Because this is an agreement negotiated with 27 other countries, Cameron can't do that in this referendum if he's in trouble with a week to go. And I think if you look at how dramatically George Osborne changed the British government's position on Turkish membership on Sunday. You know, Britain has always been the country in Europe that's been most enthusiastic about this. And on Sunday, George Osborne is saying, don't worry about this, we can veto it, it's not going to happen anytime soon. But I think because the Turkish issue is so emotive, because the public don't trust the political class on immigration, I think the only way they're going to have to be able to do this is say, look, actually, you guys get the veto on whether Turkey joins or not.
Another referendum.
And from one form of party politics to another. In this week's issue, George Hull says that young people just don't know how to rave. They are too safe and boring, and as a result, raves are dying out. Rave culture used to be rebellious. Now it's moany and conformist. I'm now joined by George, Ciarán Cale from Dazed and Confused magazine, and Paul Staines from Guido Fawkes, who used to run raves at the peak of the 80s acid house scene. So, George, have people just got boring? They don't care about raves anymore. They just want to sit at home and drink green juice.
Well, I mean, I've been doing this as promoting raves and dance events for about 15 years, since I was 18. And this year I decided, after 10 years of running a festival, which is entirely devoted to this type of thing, that there was no longer... I wouldn't say there's no more market, but the character of the crowd had changed to the extent where... That it wasn't really worth our while. So, why is that? You know, is it that the kids just don't go out anymore, or is it you know, something which has been thrust upon them by the circumstances in which they find themselves? I can only really answer from experience and from my kind of recent experience of the way that they've responded to the way that we operate and market our events. And I'd say that there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that. That the way that these things, these kind of late night events, went on in the 1980s, 1990s, it isn't really echoed in the contemporary kind of scene. And I mean, just yesterday it was announced the Office of National Statistics dropped nightclub admissions from one of the measures of consumer prices because there are actually so few nightclubs left in the UK. I think it used to be about 3,500, now there's about 1,200, and that's over 2 or 3 years. So, yeah, the reasons for this can only be... they can only be, you know, caused by the situation in which the youth find themselves.
So, what are the youth doing today to have fun then? Or are they not having fun at all? Is that not allowed?
So, I mean, I don't think I'm the only sort of representative of young people. But what I would say is that the financial pressures on young people nowadays is so extreme that it's quite difficult to go out as much as maybe our predecessors did. You know, what I would say is that most young people nowadays prefer to go to house parties, they go to pubs. It's a lot cheaper than going out to nightclubs. Young people are still going out, they are still going raving, but it's much more restrained. I think whereas before it would be okay to sort of drive to a field and stay up for 2 or 3 days, nowadays people have a lot more awareness of financial pressures and time pressures, and they feel guilty about doing that, so they might restrict themselves to 1 or 2 blowouts every couple of months, or go to a festival and that will be their sort of partying for the whole year. And most of the time they'll just prefer to be sitting in the pub with their friends or going to house parties, which is so much cheaper and sort of easier to arrange.
And Paul Staines, you used to organise raves. What was so good about them? Or have they actually been overrated for years and young people today are the wise ones? They've decided to do better things.
Well, George's article talks about the sense of freedom and also, I think, the sense of rebellion that were the raves in my day. God, it sounds awful saying in my day. You know, not only was it sort of illicit and semi-legal, you had to jump over walls to get to them, avoid police roadblocks, and of course you get there, then you have to find drugs, and it's all risky, and can you get the right drugs, and there's a sense of danger and all that kind of stuff. What I worry about with from the article of what you've just said about people, young people not going out so much, is I'd couple this story and this sense with the fall in pregnancies, which is remarkable. And I wonder if everyone's just on their mobile phones doing social media instead of going out and partying. And are they people too focused on that? And, you know, if they want to meet the opposite sex, they just go on Tinder rather than going to, you know, a rave. You know, my parents would go out jiving or whatever. That's how you met the opposite sex. So I'd couple the two stories together.
Well, actually, that's a very interesting point about mobile phones and their role in people socialising. George, have you noticed at the events you're involved in that people are spending so much time on their phones they're not actually really enjoying the events as much as they're used to, or they're so busy recording the event happening that it doesn't actually really happen?
Yeah, I think there is definitely an element of this among the kind of like the selfie generation, you know, the social media generation. The way that people enjoy and experience late night events or kind of live music events is very much characterised by, you know, the way they share those events and with their friends via social media. So people do spend an awful lot of time and effort really communicating the fact that they're actually at something over and above actually enjoying it at the time. I think that it's a shame in a way that the night and all that brings with it has gradually kind of gone down in the priority list of the youth for whatever reason. I think regulatory pressure certainly from you know local authorities has had some effect. But as Siren says, more than anything else, I think the pressure on real estate, pressure on rent, pressure on finances make it harder for kids to be able to kind of put those things at the very top of their list. So instead, they go out and less often, but when they do, they make a point of making sure everyone knows they're there via Twitter and via their Instagram, just to kind of make the point that they are still socialising.
And Siren, this must be having a real cultural impact as well on musicians who people just aren't listening to. They're probably not buying as much of their music. So are we seeing a shift in the sort of music that's really popular to go into nowadays?
I think what's interesting actually is that so much of the music scene has moved online. So, you know, you have these touring DJs who will perform often, but actually, if you look at what's happening with underground radio stations, they're sort of having a real resurgence and sort of a newfound prominence. So people might not be listening to this music, but they might be listening to it online, at work, on their phones, to podcasts.
So they're on their own still doing it?
Yeah, they're on
their own.
Sounds
very lonely.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because dance music is traditionally seen to be a way for communities to come together, whereas now you have all these new radio stations which are popping up across London, like NTS or Vince or Pulse, and they're very popular. But again, I would say people do still have an appetite for this and a real love for it. It's just unfortunately the case that they simply can't afford to go out as much anymore, particularly if, like many young people, they're working multiple jobs, perhaps at weekends when most people go out. It's really hard to find the time.
Paul Staines, do you still rave?
Not in quite the same way, I'd say.
Why is that?
Well, last summer I was with around my best friend's. He's a father, he's got kids, and we were smoking a joint in the garage to hide from the kids and our wives. And I just had a flashback to when I was 15,
hiding from your parents,
smoking a joint in the garage to hide from the parents. And I thought how things have changed, but it's still the same. Sirian is going on about how poor kids are. And you know, all these kind of hipster worries about paying the rent and multiple jobs. I think that's always been the case. Young people have never been wealthy. They've always been hard pressed financially. So I'm not sure there's anything different. Also,
how did young people afford raves before then?
You would save up from your Saturday job. You know, I think we were charging £25 a ticket, which inflation adjusted is probably £100 now or something. I don't know. You know, and you had to get there, and maybe four of you were in the back of a car and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not sure I buy that. Young people are so broke.
I think it's not so much just financial. I think it's more that young people nowadays are increasingly quite responsible, which might be a good thing. It might be a bad thing. However you look at it, you know, teenage pregnancies are going down. People are taking less drugs. They're smoking less. You know,
but if they're partying less as well, that's a bit sad, isn't it?
It's definitely a bit sad. I mean, I've had some of the best experiences of my life at parties, and I think that everyone should party and get it out of their system. And it is really sad. And I think we need to look at the reasons why this is happening. But I do feel like there's a certain amount of guilt nowadays about excessive partying, about being seen to have fun. People feel like they need to be productive all the time and focusing on their careers, which isn't always the best thing, I don't think, for young people.
So people are forgetting how to have fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think that while there is no doubt that, you know, the rent in London for the kids has basically doubled in the last few years, as Paul points out quite rightly, it was never like the role of like youth to be kind of wealthy enough to party as much as they wanted to. They always had to find a way one way or another. And I think it's very tempting to blame, you know, everything, especially in London and the South, on housing and real estate, because you can trace pretty much anything back to that particular issue these days. So perhaps there is something else going on, and you know, a slightly more abstract way of looking at it would be to say, well, perhaps the kind of this generation are just simply more puritanical than those in years gone by, and you know, you can trace kind of the puritanical versus the rebellious leanings of generation to generation right back to the, you know, Georgians, Victorians, you know, and then the 60s and punks and ravers and whatever, and it just so happens that. This particular breed seem to be less interested in the kind of all night kind of wild caution to the wind kind of attitude that was taken by Paul's generation, and what I've done, you know, as a promoter for years is cater to, if not your generation, the kind of echo of that, the acid house kind of spirit, as it were. And I feel that now that doesn't really exist. The market, they're actually quite honestly, they're satisfied with going to something during the daytime. They don't want it to kind of hurt their wallets too much, and they're not really too fussed about it being a little bit kind of dangerous or a little bit kind of extreme. Quite frankly, they'd rather it was safe and easy and cheap. And that's the kind of, that seems to me the modern zeitgeist. No doubt their children will reverse it.
That's it for this week. We're tucking ourselves up into bed at 10 p.m. Thanks for listening.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. Your landlord Mike says you wrecked his place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.